You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place!
You know, whenever we have Vietnam guys on, that's the kind of music we have to play because that's kind of what they do. So, anyway, joining me is a Vietnam guy, the Hellraiser, so the veteran population, Bob Nielsen. Bob, what's going on? How are you? Welcome back to All Marine Radio.
Good morning, Mac. I was just listening to your show a bit, listening to you impersonate Minnie Mouse. But I did want to tell you that your interview yesterday on combat action with General Neil was absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. It's an unbelievable story that we did yesterday, and it's from the Flaming Eye, India 39, up a little bit southwest of Con Tien in 1967, and in Operation Prairie. They were part of Operation Prairie 3, and the fighting up there, I mean, we haven't fought an adversary like that, I would tell you, since World War II. Korea, yeah, at times, but these guys would close with you. The NVA would use artillery, mortars, rockets, and they would be on you in a heartbeat because they knew if they didn't get to you that they were going to get annihilated. And so it's pretty crazy stuff up there by the DMZ.
They would get close in and engage, and so you couldn't use close air support.
Right. What years were you there?
I was there in 66 and left in early 67.
Okay, so you were there during this period of time, yes?
Right, but I was down south. We were south of Da Nang, between Da Nang and Chu Lai, outside of an area called Tam Kỳ. And that's where I would go on operations with 5th Marines from time to time.
Got it.
It never occurred to me that if all the officers got killed, I might be in charge, because I wouldn't have known my ass in first base.
You would have figured
General Neil was about 100 miles ahead of me.
You would have figured it out, though, like everybody else did. And what happens is, you know, he's a forward observer, and this is the day that Lieutenant Bobo, his actions are earn him the Medal of Honor that day. And company commander killed, Lieutenant Bobo killed, the platoon commander that Lieutenant Neil was with, he's wounded. The other platoon command, one platoon's cut off, and the other platoon commander was brand new. And so Neil says it. I said, at what point did you realize you were in charge? He said, well, you know, we were talking, and everybody's looking at me like, well, what do we do? And so he said, so I took over. But it's not like he was not built for that, because he is a no shit guy.
His story is so much like Barney Barnum's. It's unbelievable.
Right. It's amazing. You know, General Neil, you know, he's a garbage man for 6 years to support his mom and sister after his dad passes away. And puts himself through school, and he didn't have any affinity for the Marine Corps, but it the PLC program fit well into his requirement to work during the summer, and that's why
I love this garbage man story, because I spent part of a summer being a garbage man.
Yeah, no kidding. So I wanted to have you on today because I didn't have anybody else on, and Grant just emailed me a few minutes ago, so. He's coming on at the bottom hour. Give us an update. Give us an update on 100 entrepreneurs. What do you guys got going?
We're moving along with 100 entrepreneurs. We've got over 230 vets and families that have started businesses now. We've done it all without any government help. We continue to do our classes over at the New Walter Reed in a restaurant right in Bethesda, and we also do them down in Fort Belvoir. And we get somewhere between 20 and 25 vets or their spouses to come to the classes, and we talk about starting businesses. We got one next week, next Tuesday in Bethesda, and we're going to do it with Dog Tag Bakery. Dogtag Bakery. It's this great program that was set up in Georgetown in conjunction with Georgetown University, where they take groups of 8 or 10 veterans or caregivers and put them through a 6-month program where they teach them how to run a bakery business, but then the professors teach them how to be an entrepreneur, and they actually get their expenses reimbursed when they're doing it. It's a great program, and they come to our sessions to tell the vets the opportunities there. So it's moving along, and I'm more convinced than ever that if you can provide opportunities for veterans to start a business and something they're passionate about, just like when you're talking to the gunner about guns, you're going to trigger something in their mind, and you're going to all of a sudden get them being positive about life and going in a positive direction.
I've been doing this
for 16 years, and I've seen it again and again and again.
I want to just real quick, if you go to the Auburn Radio website, if you put in Dogtag Bakery, you're going to see the interview I did with Megan Ogilvie, right? And they offer entrepreneur fellowships, right, using their bakery as kind of a laboratory in conjunction with Georgetown University, and it doesn't cost you anything, okay? So that's pretty high-end stuff if you can swing it. So I think you got to be in the area to be able to do that. But if you are in the Northern Virginia area, it's awesome. Bob turned me on to them and said, hey, you got to have Megan on your show. And I did, and they're doing incredible. But as you said, veterans uniquely suited to be entrepreneurs, Bob?
Absolutely. I mean,
why?
We don't appreciate what entrepreneurs, what veterans know about leadership that have been in combat-related situations. You go out there to a shithole of a location, and you figure out how to put the things together to do the job you got to do. You make it work. You get the people together. You get them trained, and you lead them, and you go do it. Well, it's exactly what we do in the construction industry. And as you know, I've been sending wounded vets to Turner, both to work as interns while they were in rehab, but also to get career jobs afterwards. Last year, believe it or not, Turner, I think, hired 42 veterans as part of the overall 450 people they hired as career employees. And this year we've got a goal of 50 veterans. And a lot of them are coming out of college, but a few are coming through hearing about us on Normal Marine Radio and at my classes and the programs and stuff like that. You know, what Turner does building around the world is put teams of people together to go put a project together. Not unlike what you guys are doing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
No, and again, there's requirements for, you know, you don't need to be a construction guy. They do logistics, they do administration, they do operations. Construction is very, very, I can't remember who I had on. Who did I interview that told me, you know, Mac, it is a lot like peacetime military. He said, because you do these things every day, and there are logistics involved, there are the operations involved, there's the grunts that are out there swinging hammers, there's the administration over all of it, and it said it would remind you awfully of an awful lot about of the military.
What's interesting, Mac, is I think I told you the story. We met one of the medics that was there when Pat Horan got shot in the head 10 years ago, and he saw Sir Walter Reed 2 years ago, and couldn't believe when he saw Pat Horan alive, because he was convinced he died. And this medic was in the process of getting a medical discharge himself, got out, didn't know what to do. And about a year after we'd met, after he spent that day talking to me and Pat for an hour, he contacted me about a job. And turned out he had a little bit of construction experience, but he'd been a medic in the Army for 8 or 10, 12 years. And I got him with Turner, and he's a safety superintendent. And he absolutely loves the job. And they're the guys that ensure on all our projects we adhere to the safety standards and all the OSHA rules and things like that. And he's found a niche that makes him just happy as can be. So here he goes seeing Pat Horan for the first time in 10 years and realized that Pat had actually lived and has made a remarkable recovery. And now we got him working with Turner. Alan, you know, what a great win-win that is.
That's awesome. Do you ever get do you ever get tired of working with veterans? So you know what, these guys are jackasses, man. These guys are jackasses.
No. There's nothing more amazing than watching these young men and women, and I don't give a shit what branch of service or what rank, but they're gung-ho, they're can-do attitude. We got a couple of young ones in there right now that have been in Syria and multiple tours and all sorts of stuff, and they're phenomenal, absolutely unbelievable. And then they've got ideas on starting businesses that might be able to help people that need medical care in the Middle East. It's amazing to talk to these young men and women.
Wow. All right. What's next for 100 Entrepreneurs?
Well, we're going to continue what we're doing because even though the wars have slowed down and there's not as many wounded, as you well know, once you've been in combat, the shit never goes away.
Right.
And these veterans need to interact with other veterans, and they need to look at opportunities, and they need to look at opportunities for that are going to suit them and that they can be passionate about. And so, you know, we got how many hundreds of thousands of vets that have been in combat, and these opportunities we got to make available to them. And, you know, as you constantly talk with people on your program about post-traumatic growth, is communicating with these vets when they're getting depressed and getting frustrated. It's being able to show them that there's opportunities out there, and if you can get your fingers into something that you're passionate about, you're going to be a much better person. And you're not going to be sitting there watching TV, you know, drinking a half a case of beer in the afternoon.
Yeah, whoever's doing that, knock it off. All right. First of all, thanks for the update. Anything else we should know about?
I wanted to tell you one other thing.
Yeah, this is the general question. Anything else we should know about?
One other thing. I know you're going to have Grant Newsham on again.
Yes.
He is absolutely phenomenal. He knows more about the insights of Asia and what's going on over there and the culture of it. And I want you to ask him questions about the money that the Chinese control outside of China and all the countries around Southeast Asia.
So the question should center around what?
Expat Chinese in Vietnam, in Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, and the amount of capital they control in those countries.
Okay, so.
And then also.
Who owns those businesses that are doing that investing?
That's right.
Okay.
And also the foreign businesses from China, the overseas businesses from China that are owned by the Chinese army.
What?
I think you'll be intrigued at the answers.
What? The Chinese army owns businesses?
In the 90s, I believe the majority of the businesses overseas were either owned or controlled by the Chinese army. But Grant's a lot smarter than me. He'll have a good answer.
When will it end, Nielsen? When will it end?
Good question.
Okay. All right. Before I let you go, Mr. Kim playing us for a chump, or is he actually going to make some kind of agreement?
That is a great question. I wouldn't believe a word the North Koreans said. If they told me the sun was out today, I'd make sure I went out and stuck my eyeball out the window to check it. So I have no clue. I got a feeling they might have had problems with their nuclear program with the explosions in the mountain.
Right.
And were set back more than they realized. And now they got to try to save face.
Ooh.
But who the hell knows?
All right. So you would categorize yourself, as Grant does, cautiously pessimistic?
Very cautiously pessimistic.
Very cautiously pessimistic. All right, sir. First of all, happy anniversary. 50 years of marriage. How did your wife ever?
Last Friday, my wife and I went up to a place out of sight of Wilmington, Delaware, Longwood Gardens, and went to tour and with my son and his wife and my sister and her husband and my brother-in-law, we celebrated our 50th anniversary. Had a great time.
Awesome. Well, happy anniversary.
How she put up with my shit for 50 years, I'll never know.
She's not the smartest woman on the planet. She gets she's not too smart, but she gets high marks for loyalty.
She's the best.
Congratulations to you. Not sure how you pulled that off, but congratulations to actually both of you. 50 years of marriage. That's a great achievement, Bob. Thank you for hopping on today.
Interestingly enough, we met 50 years ago when I got back from Vietnam and first got out of St. Olin's Hospital. So
so she's a thrill seeker, too. She's one of those girls. She's a bad girl. She likes bad boys then.
Well, actually, believe it or not, one of her best friends had been killed in Vietnam 6 months before.
Yeah, so why is she hanging out with you?
Because she saw the value of a good Marine.
Oh, shit. So she, you know what?
You might have to edit this show.
No, I was just going to say, we need to get her on the program one day.
No way in the world.
Yeah, why not? Don't be a pussy. All right, have a good one.
She thinks I'm crazy sitting here listening to you every day.
Nah, she should know. Tell her we need her on the program.
Okay.
All right, have a good one.
Great talking to Mac.
All right, there you have it. Bob Nielsen, he of the 100 Entrepreneur Project. And now joining me from Montana is the one and only Montana Man. What's up, Montana Man?
Oh, up in the back of the ranch trying to get some grass sprayed out of an alfalfa field.
Grass sprayed out of alfalfa fields. And so you got a tractor? You got a spreader? What do you got going?
Well, I got a spray guy who's got a side-by-side with a 55-gallon tank on it.
How much that set you back? Is that pricey or is that pretty affordable?
I think it comes out to about $15 an acre for chemical, and then he's probably a few hundred dollars to get it done.
So
not bad.
Yeah, you think the Mexicans have to spray that stuff on, or do you think they deal with that? Probably don't spend as much as you are, right?
Probably not, but I don't know many Mexican ranchers up here.
Well, I'm just talking about Mexican ranchers in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, I don't know how they run their operations.
Yeah. All right. Well, give us an update. Rob Schwartz joins us. How are things going in Montana? The weather's we notice is gotten warmer. How are the calves doing? Last time we talked to you, the calves were at risk.
Yeah, no, they're all good. They're just sliding out like butter now.
So we're good with that. So the calf situation, was it simply a function of the weather being harsh and them being new and fragile?
Yeah, they come out wet when it's 5 degrees out and 2 foot of snow on the ground. They don't have much time before they got to get dried off and warm. So that's a lot of work. Now it's kind of, I check them once a day, and if there's new ones out there, I'll run out and tag them and band them, and we're done.
How do you know? So do you begin monitoring them if you know they're about to go into labor? And how do you know a cow's about to go into labor?
They generally kind of ease off on their own, find a place to be by themselves, and they kind of pace around a little bit. And then a big old pink bubble comes out their back end, and you know they're just about ready to go.
And so do you monitor that when they do that and bring them someplace, or do you tag them? And if explain this to me.
Well, now I just let them be and don't bug them and
now,
come
but,
back. And
but when the weather
later, yeah.
But when the weather acts up and they might be dead if you don't do that, how do you monitor them? Do you electronically monitor them?
You
do you visually monitor them?
You visually monitor them.
You don't fly the drone? And then, you don't hover the drone over the cow?
No. You would probably friggin' send them running.
Oh, it would? You got to get a better drone then. You got to get a quiet drone. What else is going on? So what's next? You're spraying alfalfa. What else? You're calving. Anything else?
Yeah, I got some... I got my breeding donkey and two of my mares going back to Idaho with a guy this day. I got to get back and meet him. Do some artificial insemination, collect off the donkey, and artificially inseminate some mares. So hopefully I got some baby mules next spring. And then I got to unscrew the lawnmower because we got flat tires and the grass is out of control. So that's the day.
That's the day? So what do you, the grass is out of control. Does that mean the intern's got to mow or you got to mow or Alicia's got to mow? Who's mowing?
Well, it's going to be me because the interns don't show up till the end of the month.
Oh.
And then I got to try and put together an elite herding team because I'm going to move cow-calf pairs up to the corrals a week from Saturday, so I got to get a group together to do that, and then we're going to turn them out on pasture, and then it really becomes no impact. Check them every few days, and they're good for the next, well, till September, October time frame before we bring them back in.
All right. Couple of opinion. So everything sounds like you got it between the left and lateral, right lateral limits right now. Yes or no?
We are in between the ditches.
All right, all right. Israel and Iran. How does that thing go?
I think with the way we've been supporting Israel,
yes,
and we're kind of giving them a little bit more rein and letting them go, that it's just a matter of time before they start getting rockets inside Iran, which is what I've been waiting for.
So explain the sequence of events. Do the Iranians in Syria shoot a rocket into because here's what's looming out there. Israeli missile strikes to Iran and then southern Lebanon exploding with and the Israeli civilian population paying for that. When that happens, will the Israelis exact two for one on the Iranian home soil? Make them play a home game for once? Because that's until you make them pay for it, this shit will go on and on and on, in my opinion.
Yeah, that whole just hitting the surrogate countries that they're using the shootout of is not, you know, it's not a big deal to them, I don't believe. And they'll just keep doing what they're doing until we go to the homeland.
That's how the system got designed, right? Like, I mean, the last war they fought was against the Iraqis, and they dumped chemical weapons on each other. That did not go over well in the homeland, just so everybody knows. Iranian people were not a big fan of that. And so, I think until they play a home game, it's all the way they've designed it. Yeah, this is great. We have some advisors, yeah, and that's tragedy. But guess what? We're destabilizing and having greater influence in the entire region at virtually, you know, no real physical cost to us. It's costing us money. But, hell, the Americans gave us a ton of that. And now that we're selling oil, we get more and more of it every day. So what the hell? So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer for them until Israel. And wouldn't it be great for us to actually just stand behind someone and instead of being the one in the lead the whole time? You know, to be able to stand back and go, yeah, we support them. We support them with arms. We support them with sanctions. We support them with all these things. But, you know, there's no U.S. troops involved in it. Play our own surrogate war.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, especially if you got a good surrogate, too, like the Israelis. Like, hello.
Yeah, they're the best.
And, you know, that's what the Saudis are saying. Hey, Mr. President, why don't you just unleash the Jews on the Iranians? Like, say you support them. Get them after them. Get them on the run. You could hear the Saudis saying that. Like, yeah, we could actually get into it with them, but come on. That would be so messy. The Israelis will hammer them with a shit hammer of their gods, man. We don't want any part of that. So, yeah, the Saudis and in fact, I just saw that the Saudis, if you can imagine this, are going to allow the Israelis to use their country, their airspace for overflight. Hello.
That's big.
That's big. Because they didn't used to even acknowledge that they existed. They existed.
Right.
Text message. Hey, Mac, thanks for doing the Mr. Bill or Hummingbird voice when I took a sip of my coffee this morning. Perhaps a heads up prior to commencing. Luckily, I was outside. Funny shit. Let me just tell you, I'm going to say this again. It's pathetic. All the quality stuff I do, and I don't hear shit about it. And all of a sudden, I do the Hummingbird people, and Montana Man was like all over it yesterday. He thought that was some good shit. You like the Hummingbird people, yes?
The yoga pants Mickey, as I'm calling. But I was freaking rolling. It plays on the radio in the shop, and I'm kind of in and out. And I heard the Yoga Pants Mickey Mouse debating you on it, on the what's going on in the world and current events, and I had to stop and listen. I was freaking howling, just back and forth. That was quality shit. I mean, I know you're a much more intellectual guy than that, but I think that goes down as one of the
classic
top hours of the year so far.
That's pathetic. See what I mean? It's very intellectually, it's very disappointing. You try to do all this good stuff, and then what raises the roof? Yoga pants, Mickey Mouse. It's like, God damn it, man. This is killing me. Yeah, Dave in Vacaville, he's all over that. Yeah, I had four other people, then a bunch of email. I'm like, this is depressing. Absolute depressing. All right, what else you got going on today?
I'm going to scoot back down to the ranch, pick up tires, head to town, try and get back by the time this guy comes back to get these horses, grab some Roundup so I can maybe get back up here to the top of the ranch and keep the spray guy going on some other stuff that I just want to totally kill off if the wind cooperates. And then hopefully at that point, it'll be getting dark.
Wow. All right. All right. Well, first of all, thanks for the update. All right, you're a go-to.
When I
got no content, you're a go-to.
Good.
All right, there you have it. Montana Man. Have a good one, Rob.
All right, see you, Mac.
Yeah, formerly the executive officer of RCT-1 in Afghanistan, Robbie Schwartz, known as Montana Man. Montana, that's a cool nickname. Gunner's a cool nickname. F-18 Man's a cool nickname. I see. I have my boys up. All right, should we take a break or just press to Grant? I told him 8:30. How about I surprise him and call him on time? How about I will do that? There you have it. Grant Newsham coming up right now.
Sounds good.
Newsham, McNamara, welcome to All Marine Radio on a Thursday morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Where in the world are you?
Oh, just Hawaii.
Oh, well, good morning then.
Nothing much, yeah. Mm-hmm. Morning.
All right, so what do you make? The charm offensive continues. I don't even call him the Dictator Kim because we don't want to make him mad. Evidently, some of the rhetoric coming out of the United States about him bowing to Donald Trump's superior diplomatic skills angered him. And so just to register his displeasure, he met with Dictator Xi and said, I don't like the rhetoric coming out of the United States, so we're trying to tone ours down. Because we do have listeners in Beijing, just so you know. What do you make of it? Releases American hostages, and we have now a date, June 12th in Singapore. Your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly entertaining, and it's better than the usual runaround that we've gotten for the last 25 years. It's entertaining. It's always been furrow-browed foreign service officers and diplomats going into meetings here and there and then coming out looking serious and stern and saying the same things. But at least now you have, you saw that picture of Mike Pompeo towering over Kim Jong-un and yeah. Kim Jong-un actually arching his back backwards, which is quite a... Hadn't seen anything like that if you compare it to Madeleine Albright with his beaming smile and sort of a double handshake to Kim's father, or when Jimmy Carter went and the North Koreans had him sitting, filmed it, so it looked like he was about 2 feet tall and Kim, the senior, was towering over him. So seeing the Americans actually, doing something different is refreshing. As far as getting back the hostages, I'm just less impressed with that. Partly because there's always three more to grab, whenever we want. And really, they shouldn't have been taken in the first place. I think quietly releasing them might have been a little better, but that's, you know, that's nitpicking.
Yes, it is.
But it's certainly good entertainment, and, you know, it, we will see. You know, the meeting in Singapore doesn't surprise me. It's a good place because probably more than any other free country or civilized country, Singapore has done its best over the years to bankroll North Korea and allow North Korea's illicit activities to continue. The only thing they minded was getting caught doing it, but it's really been a very strange thing to watch an otherwise very admirable government having treated North Korea the way they have over the years. So it is ironic they're meeting in Singapore. I think the North Koreans will be very comfortable given their long-standing relationship with Singapore.
Okay, why did he meet with Xi again here recently? What was that about?
No, go ahead.
No, what was that about?
You know, if you read all the commentary on this, what you realize is that nobody knows. It's, you know, and I'm sort of laughing because there's probably a million words written on it every day. There's probably 2,000 people at least who follow this really closely, and none of them know. There's lots of speculation. But I think one could draw some reasonable inferences from it, is that it's certainly China making sure that their interests and their position is recognized, and that the North Koreans are under no illusions that they had better pay attention to what China wants. It also suggests that it gives a lie to what China has been saying for many years, is that they have no influence over North Korea. And yet here they snap their fingers and Kim comes to see them twice, and he even flies in an airplane to come see them one of those times. And that's stuff he's never done, and Korean leaders have been reluctant to do. So it does demonstrate that China does still have all the influence it needs over North Korea, that North Korea does, ultimately will do what China wants. And also some concern. I think it's probably accurate that China was afraid of getting left out, I think there's probably some truth to that. That is my take, is that the appearance that the South Koreans have brought the North Koreans and the Americans together without the Chinese being directly involved, either as hosts or being consulted publicly at least, that has unnerved the Chinese a bit. And I think they're just making it sure that Kim doesn't do anything strange, but from their perspective, and realizes that he'd better pay attention to China. Just to say some observations, but it is funny just how nobody really knows. And there's a lot of speculation, but I think there's some sort of a little common sense. You can probably figure out the basic motivations here.
All right. What about, I had an email after you were on the last time from Bob Nielsen, who's a great mentor of mine here in terms of being an entrepreneur and navigating all of this. But he's a construction guy after he's Vietnam era Marine. Got out and been helping veterans ever since. Had a career with Turner Construction, so he's been around the world. And he said, Mac, the next time you have Grant on, ask him about who owns these businesses that go into all these other countries from China. So Grant, all this, the Belt and Road, you know, program, all these, this Chinese investment, these business, quote unquote, businesses that invest in other countries, who owns all that?
That's actually an excellent question. Given Mr. Nielsen's background, I'm not surprised he asked it. But it doesn't get asked as often as you'd think it would. And I think the simple answer is that these are by and large, there's a private people who own them. So there are sort of private, what you call private Chinese entrepreneurs or businessmen who own these things and start them up. In most cases, unless it's, say, one of the big national, just a state-owned company. But most of these things, it is Chinese entrepreneurs on display, but the difference is that if in an American context, if, say you were a businessman and you, say it was you and you started up, say, Marine Radio, and you, needed $20 million. If you could go over to the Department of Treasury and ask for $20 million and get it, it's a strange kind of entrepreneurialism.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so it's really the private sector with a government connection, backstop, and even you find that the government can actually issue orders to these companies if it wants to. But it's not quite like a really well-organized sort of, I don't call it, enterprise or criminal, semi-criminal enterprise like you would have with, say, Spectre in a James Bond movie where everything is directed by Spectre, but rather it is this odd mix of sort of Chinese industriousness, commercial industriousness, with a government backstop in a lot of cases, and the ability of the government to direct it when need be. It's not as if the companies will call up Beijing every day and say, what do we do? But if there's something that the Chinese government needs to put its finger on, get its hand on to further its interests, that it can easily and reach out and control these companies as they want. And you will see that some of these big tycoons, for want of a better word, that have created these really big Chinese private companies through this method that I've sort of described, that a couple of them have been arrested when they got too big. They've been, you know, one case kidnapped in Hong Kong, brought back to China, and then they confessed to something. But you can get too successful. And this, so that's, one way, that's, I think, a pretty accurate way of looking at it, that it is this mixture of sort of in Chinese industriousness with the Communist Party and the resources of the Chinese state.
All right. Does the Chinese army or military or DOD own businesses?
They do. The PLA, the People's Liberation Army, for a long, long time had just immense business activities, business operations. There's less of it now, but in around 1999-2000, the Chinese Communist Party ordered the PLA to divest itself of its private industry, private businesses, you know, like hotels, hospitals, auto parts stores, almost anything you could think of, and they didn't do it, but then the Chinese Communist Party ordered them that they do it again after about a decade, and they did a little of it, but not a whole lot. But now, as I understand it, there's a lot less of it than there was. So they are still involved in illicit activity, like a lot of counterfeiting that goes on. You will find the PLA involved in both legal and illegal commercial activity. But they say there's less of it than there was. And it's some sort of a sign, I think, that the Communist Party, but also Xi in particular, has brought the army under control. And there's always been debate over how much it was ever was or wasn't under control. But I think it did have more independence about a decade or two decades ago than it does today, would be my sense of it. But they used to be just into everything commercially, which I thought was good, because if you're doing that, you're not so good at fighting. And now there's a lot less of it, and they've professionalized themselves more than one would wish. But that's how it looks to me.
All right. Can you explain to us how does the financing work with the Belt and Road initiative the Chinese have? They come to me and they say, okay, McNamara, in your port here along whatever, we want to, we would like to enter into an agreement with you to provide the labor and improve your port and also to improve this road, between our border and your port. We'll provide the labor for that too. And then what we want from you is what, explain how this works, Grant, in terms of, because I've read that this isn't aid, right? We're not going to donate this for the development of this road to our joint benefit. This is a loan. So explain to me how this works.
The last thing that you noted is that is one difference in the activities that the Chinese, both commercial and government, do around the world, is that very little of it is what you would call direct aid, where you're just giving money so that a country can do something useful for themselves. But rather it's lent on a commercial basis, which is you pay me. If you think, sort of a loan shark on 42nd and 6th Street, he'll lend you money, but he's going to charge you a high rate, and you better repay him. And that's ultimately, that's one pretty good way to look at the financing, the financial end of what the Chinese do is overseas and part of this One Belt, One Road. And you described at the beginning pretty well how it works is Chinese people are out drumming up business all over the place. And it does tie into larger national interests, but it really is a lot of Chinese businessmen just everywhere and drumming up business. And this is, one can criticize it, if you want, but nonetheless, there is a lot of initiative here that the Chinese are taking. And I heard this was about a decade ago. But a guy just, he explained this all to me, and he said, remember how you used to hear of this thing called the Yankee Trader, which was these Americans everywhere selling things, drumming, looking for business, looking for a way to make money. Now you used to see them everywhere in just four corners of the world. And he says, these days you just don't see them. And now it's the Chinese who are out playing that role that the Yankee traders used to do. Yes, there's plenty of American business going on overseas, but if you go to the guy explained is you look at Ethiopia. There used to be Americans here, and the Ethiopians will tell you this. Where's the Americans? They used to be here, and now it's China. And you go almost anywhere, and you will find Chinese businessmen of different scales. Could be guys selling like plastic fly swatters or people selling power generators, out looking for business, looking for a way to make money. The bigger infrastructure projects, which are generally associated with the One Belt, One Road, you'll find more of a direct government involvement in this, and also with the companies that get involved in this, just the nature of that sort of work. But it really is full court press is, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's certainly really just widespread sort of effort by a lot of different Chinese to go out and make some money. It's what the Chinese do. I think that's probably the Chinese Communist Party gets too much credit for having improved things because all they had to do was really stop murdering and starving the population and just let natural Chinese industriousness take over. But one thing to consider is that there's often a sort of rapaciousness to Chinese commercial activity, which almost always puts local businesses out of business. And that's what it intends to do. Some reason there's a sense of, isn't really a sense of competition, except in the sense once you've exterminated your opposition, that's the ideal situation for a Chinese businessman. So it creates a lot of resentment in these countries. It takes, in a lot of countries, and it takes a while sometimes for it to build up. But it does create resentment, this locust-like behavior that you do often find. And as you said, Sri Lanka is another, is an excellent case. There's been others that the Chinese were particularly with the infrastructure projects. They lend a lot of money for a project they have talked the locals into. And they've also, usually there's some bribes that have been paid, you know, huge payments into Switzerland, take your pick. And so a company takes on more loan than it, more, takes on more debt than it should. And once it can't repay it, the Chinese don't, they're not as nice as us. But we would just keep offering more money. The Chinese will take something, and as they did in Sri Lanka, have effectively taken a port and an airfield, and which, if you think about it, this is looks a lot like colonialism, but without the, I suppose, the altruism of the British, I suppose.
I have an email for you, Mac. Ask Grant what ultimately North Korea will seek from the United States. So, pull out, you're a Harry Potter guy. Pull out your crystal ball. What ultimately does North Korea want from us?
I think it wants us to recognize them as sort of an equal, kind of as an equal, and that would be a huge accomplishment for them to have the Americans say, "Yeah, North Korea, you're in our ballpark. You know, you're a regular, respected country." And I think they would like that. But I also think they want to keep their nuclear weapons. And so this is where I think it's all going to get hung up on, is if America insists that North Korea give up its nuclear program, I just don't see North Korea doing that, or at least not doing it honestly. But I think ultimately, it comes down to North Korea wanting the Americans to say, okay, we accept you as you are. You're part of the group. And we will overlook, the gulag and all the torture that you're doing and everything else you've done, but we'll just take you as you are. And I say I don't see the North giving up its nuclear weapons, and I think it would like to improve its economy, but I don't think it quite knows how to do it. It's had so much it's been so long that it's run this horrible system where people starve to death, I think so they'd like to fix the economy, but I think they're not quite able to do it just yet. So ultimately, I think it's a question of respect in some ways. That's sort of the short answer.
Okay, but the problem with your answer is that if that was all it was about and there wasn't anything substantive, Pompeo wouldn't have gone there twice, Trump wouldn't be meeting with him, and he would not have released those three detainees, for lack of a better word, people he kidnapped. So what is being dangled in front of the United States, do you think, that is having us cooperate with him?
And your point is well taken, because Secretary Pompeo and I don't think he would have gone back to North Korea if there wasn't some, something that he thought that the Americans could get from this. And there's been other discussions going on as well, of course. And so somebody thinks that these are worthwhile discussions worth having. And presumably they've heard something from the North Koreans that lead them to believe this. I'm skeptical, of course, I think, as you probably got that impression. But I think there's been something that has attracted the Americans, held out hope that North Korea will do what we want in terms of getting rid of its nuclear program and somehow reining in its missile program. And implicit in all this is improved North Korean behavior. So there's some reason for the Americans to think that this time is different and that North Korea really does want to make a deal, wants to do things differently and establish a new relationship.
Here's my theory is he's tired of hanging out with his sister in North Korea. This is my theory. He was educated in Switzerland, so he knows a good time when he sees one. And now he's imprisoned in this shithole of a country, and he's hanging out with his sister. Now, this is not the life of a leader of a nation. So I need to get back into the mainstream so I can go party around the world. This is crazy, this life I'm living. You know, I've got, for God's sakes, I've got Dennis Rodman coming over here. Okay, that's how bad it is. So I think he's driven by his own social desire for a better social life. But he has made curious statements about his economy as well. That, you know, I need our people to live better and things like that. So if we do the Olympic thing, which is throw out the high and throw out the low, what are we left with? So if we throw out the high is he completely disarms, right? And we're allowed to inspect. And we throw out the low, which is that somehow or other the Korean War will sign documents and some kind of non-aggression, you know, deal or whatever. Where does the rest of the deal go? If he's not going to completely give up his nuclear program, does he pause it? And is that verifiable without completely making it go away? Is that good enough for us to proceed? What would be your educated assessment?
I think it, like a lot of these things, it usually comes out somewhere in the middle.
Right.
I think that's probably a pretty good sort of thing to expect, is that he isn't going to offer up everything, like bring all of his weapons out on a truck and hand it over to us. But I think he'd probably offer up something that looks attractive, that gives us the, allows us to say, yeah, we've got it under control, we're able to inspect. He's put it on hold. So he'd probably offer up something like that along those lines. It would be my guess, but it won't be he's not going to prostrate himself in front of us, the Americans, and give up everything. And in return, I think he does, as you noted, he does want, I think he has a sense that the economy really isn't very good, not what it should be. And I think he generally does want it to be better, but I don't think he knows how to do it. I think he wants somebody else to do it. And the question remains, is he willing to really transform the nature of that regime to allow some sort of economic progress? And that would require, because by comparison, China is a pretty free place compared to North Korea, but it would require a real transformation in that government, that system. The Koreans are pretty good, actually, at start turning on a dime when they feel like it. The South Koreans have done it a few times, and particularly in connection with when they've had economic difficulties. They have shown an impressive ability of the entire nation basically to get together and change its behavior and even to sacrifice. So you never know. And as you said, the psychological element in all of this that tends to get overlooked, that, you know, maybe the guy just is tired of, you know, he'd rather be in Switzerland, or would rather be hanging out with Dennis Rodman, you know, at basketball games.
Yeah, at an NBA game, not like a professional North Korean basketball game. Come on, that's
wonderful. You know, you never quite know just how, you know, these guys are humans, and right, they do things that, you know, we don't think leaders of countries actually think about or are interested in. It does shape their thinking, and, you know, there is an element of that. He's just tired of this. You know, we'll find out. And that's what's so interesting, is that just how quickly this idea of Mr. Trump and Kim meeting has come about. And it's not anything, I don't think anybody would have predicted it. One recalls a year ago that the commentariat was pulling its hair out because Mr. Trump was going to go to war.
Right.
You know, it was a sure thing. Everybody knew this irresponsible, crazy Trump was going to start a war. And, well, this is not exactly starting a war. As I said, it's pretty interesting compared to everything that's come before it. And it's certainly entertaining. But, you know, who would have thought this would have happened? But we'll see. But it's, you know, I'm not convinced the North will offer up enough to satisfy us. But at the same time, they might offer enough that it's worth talking some more.
Well, but don't you think they've had to have offered something that would allow the President of the United States to be involved? Or else I can't see him going if it was like, well, we're just going to get together to talk. No, because that's you using me to legitimize yourself. I can't allow that. So, I mean, there has to be something that has been communicated to the President of the United States who's been full of, I don't want to say love is not the right word, but he continues to talk about the relationship he has with President Xi. And then when Kim took the train ride to Beijing, after he left, he said he had a very, very positive phone call with President Xi, and he was looking forward to the meeting. You know, I know it can go wrong, but, you know, we're trying to be optimistic. And you heard that rhetoric. So to me, there's something there that's been offered, that he thinks is doable, is achievable, which is intriguing about the whole thing, because other than that, he would be being played, as you said, the whole Lucy and the football analogy would be absolutely spot on if there wasn't something worth meeting for. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, it's got to be something. If it was another administration, I wouldn't think so.
Right.
But certainly if John Bolton's around, you know, I would tend to think the North, somebody's heard something from the North that makes them think it's worth meeting. Because this is the one administration that I think would not be willing to meet just to meet. And this is a good thing, so we'll see.
Well, no, when you line them up, like, okay, Pompeo, right? And you throw Mattis and Dunford in there. Pompeo, Mattis, Dunford, and John Bolton. They're all going to be bobbleheads? They'd be bobbleheads, but in a different direction. They would not be bobbleheads towards a meeting and an agreement because they have been on record as saying that it is a bad regime, and those are their statements universally, and so it is interesting. Anyway, all right. So you wrote a piece here recently talking about allowing the Japanese to take more risk. Tell me about it.
Yeah, what kind of the piece was about was the current scandal or controversy that's going on in Japan over, and what it is when the Japanese army was in South Sudan recently, its daily logs went missing, and when it was in Iraq, its daily logs went missing as well. And the opposition in Japan, opposition parties, demanded to see the logs, and they were claiming that the logs were hidden because it indicated that in South Sudan it was dangerous and in Iraq it was dangerous. And that's the dispute, is that the opposition is saying, well, the Japanese army, the Japanese military was in these places and it was dangerous. Therefore, they should have been brought home. And it shows how how bad the government is for hiding this fact from the public that Iraq and South Sudan were dangerous places. I'm not making this up. And they're serious when they make this argument. So what I'm pointing out is that there's always been this belief in part of the Japanese political world that the Japanese, when they go overseas, should be immune from any danger. It should be carefully laid out so that when they go somewhere, they are not exposed to the slightest bit of danger, and that all the parties in these countries should agree that they will not threaten or bother or harm or do anything that will make the Japanese uncomfortable. Now, what I point out is this really is irrelevant, and it's pretty stupid, actually, and that Japan needs to grow up and take on the same sorts of risks that every other country on Earth does when they send troops overseas. When the Japanese army does go overseas, they do very well, as the rest of the Japanese military does. But they're being hamstrung politically, and it's not a good thing, I think, for the country nor for the Japanese military. did the, and I think actually, and I note that it's actually, they should be grateful that the logs actually went missing. Because if Japan had pulled out of South Sudan and Iraq at the first sign of anything even remotely dangerous, they would have looked ridiculous. I actually say that I didn't quite write it, but they should probably give a medal or at least an award to the guys who made the logs disappear. But they didn't really disappear. They were around. They just didn't highlight them. And it took a little while to find them once they were requested. But it's a scandal or a controversy that would only be a controversy in Japan.
Are they beginning, though, to at least have the debate about changing their constitution? Because, you know, the menace to the West cannot be denied, you know, and the confrontation that is looming with the Japanese, with the Chinese. I mean, the Chinese just drove their one aircraft carrier near Taiwan. They had live fire exercises in the East China Sea. So it's coming to a theater near you, and the only thing we're sure of is that it's one day closer to happening. Are the Japanese beginning to have a discussion about, hey, hello, you know, depending on the United States, might not be in our best interest. We at least need to be able to field what we should field. And is that debate going on? Because I'm hoping that it happens in Japan, and then the freeloading Germans will at least watch the Japanese and say, you know, they seem to have gotten over World War II. Maybe we should do the same so we can keep Mr. Putin in a box.
You know, the debate is not really happening in Japan. There are people who understand what Japan needs to do, politicians, military types, and the public writ large, I think, kind of understands it. But the opposition to it is, well, it is a minority, it's noisy and it's bothersome. So the Japanese tendency is usually, a lot of things controversial, is to ignore it and just hope something kind of works out. But I don't really see Japan doing really what it needs to do to bolster its defense and really get an organized, ordered policy for defending the country. I think it's probably going to take a North Korean or some missile right into Tokyo to wake them up. But I just don't see that. It's not to say they have no defense, but it's just that it needs to be straightened out and I think made more effective. They really are hamstrung by this anti-war, anti-military opposition. That really is straight out of the 1960s, and they've not had a government that's been able to really make the case to the public at large to do what the country needs. Abe's done better than most, but he faces a lot of opposition. One thing he has in common with Mr. Trump is that the opposition is absolutely unhinged towards Mr. Abe, just as it is towards Mr. Trump.
He likes to play golf, too.
That, too.
Mm-hmm. All right, sir. First of all, thanks for hopping on this morning. As always, we appreciate it. And when's your next big trip? Are you going to be in Hawaii for a while, or what do you got going?
I don't know. I'll probably go somewhere. Maybe I think Japan is probably the most likely. But I'll be here for a little bit now.
Okay. All right. So what we should so throwing out the high and the low – and some kind of hybrid agreement that doesn't maybe eliminate all his nuclear weapons, but allows us to verify that he maybe a moratorium on testing and a freeze at a certain level in exchange for whatever, and we can sign an agreement that ends the war and whatnot. Something in the middle like that esque, maybe.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe it wouldn't surprise me if this one, they just agreed to, you know, they finish it up and Mr. Trump comes out and says, I had a great meeting, with Kim and my guys are going to meet his guys after this. It's going to be some more talks. I'm not sure what they'll actually come up with at this meeting.
Or maybe another meeting in Washington, D.C.
Something, that would be my guess. I could be wrong, but I think it may take, assuming it, Trump doesn't leave in a huff for some reason, that it may take some more meetings to see what is actually going to come of all of this.
That would make sense. That would make sense.
Just be my prediction. Talk about an easy prediction, but I think that's maybe where it's gonna go.
The dance. Okay. All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much, and have a great day.
Okay, thanks a lot.
There you have it, Grant Newsham. Throw out the high and the low, and then we'll go from there. And again, but there is something propelling the President of the United States to this meeting. Something's been said, because Donald Trump continues to raise expectations with some of the comments that he makes. And then right after he says it, he says, now nothing could come of it. But there's something that's out there that is causing him to meet. And he wouldn't do that because that meeting in and of itself gives greater stature to the dictator of North Korea. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, the Gunner's getting his Botox treatment today. Yep. Getting his Botox treatment. So we'll go ahead and we'll check in with him. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.